Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman starts us off today wondering what happened to the Obama narrative of hope and change. In Friedman's latest book, That Used to Be Us, just released in paperback and written with Michael Mandelbaum, he writes about an integrated set of policies wrapped in a narrative about the future that could define a second Obama term. But where is it? We'll talk about the Middle East, too, which Thomas Friedman follows closely. Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming back on WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
In your column last month, you quoted the president saying one of his biggest mistakes has been thinking his job was only about getting the policy right. And I want to play that clip and get your thoughts.
The mistake of my first couple of years was thinking that this job was just about getting the policy right. And that's important. But, you know, the nature of this office is also to tell a story to the American people that gives them a sense of unity and purpose and optimism, especially during tough times. It's funny, when I ran, everybody said, well, you can give a great speech, but can he actually, you know, manage the job? And then my first 2 years, I think the notion was, well, you know, he's been juggling and managing a lot of stuff, but, you know, where's the story that tells us where he's going? And I think that was a legitimate criticism.
The president last month with Charlie Rose on CBS and Tom Friedman, even in describing his need to inspire people, he was so introspective and low key.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it goes back, Brian, I think, to the very beginning, because this has been a criticism I've had of him from the get-go, is that I've always wondered whether Obama fully understood why he was elected. And what do I mean by that? I think Obama's nomination as the first African-American president really was the crowning achievement of the American civil rights movement. But I think his election was actually made possible by something else. It was made possible because a majority of Americans wanted to do something and knew we needed to do something, and that is nation building at home. They intuited that we're falling behind, and they really looked at Obama as a guy who both had that vision and they thought could pull the country together for that project. Now, I think actually if you look at a lot of the things he did, he was actually embarked on that project. If you look at, to me, his education policy, race to the top, health care, the infrastructure part of the stimulus, his attempts on green energy. To me, they are all component parts of an agenda of nation building in America for the 21st century. But he never branded them that way. He never brought it together that way. He basically was a kind of serial policymaker. He fought each battle independently and fought each coalition against him independently and never leveraged the public to say, wait a minute, this is the great project. This is a component of that project. I need your help.
Between him and all the smart people around him, why do you think, and the fact that you even support those policies and you think most of the building blocks are there, why do you think we're hearing this narrative about the future from you in those kinds of words, but not from him?
You know, he would toss it out every once in a while. And in the course of interviews, you know, I had a chance to talk to the president about this, you know, over the last 3 years episodically. Brian, I think it's one of the questions historians will really puzzle about. And I think part of it has to do – and it's embedded in his answer there to Charlie Rose. You know, the president's a great reader of blogs and newspapers and columns. And I think part of it is that he took on Hillary's criticism. Oh, he can give a great speech. Enough with the speeches. You know what I mean? I think he actually, as we sometimes do, you know, absorbed all the criticism and said, oh, you think I'm just about speeches? Cut the speeches. I'm just going to do the policy. And I think he took it a little too seriously and deprived himself of one of his great skills and one of his great tools for leveraging his agenda.
And I heard him do it at the beginning of his administration, the very beginning of his administration, like the first weeks, and said, I'm going to use the opportunity of this financial crisis to build the America of the 21st century on three things: energy, the environment,
right,
and healthcare.
Yes.
Modernized healthcare,
yeah,
system. And then he fought all those battles, yes, won some, lost some, but dropped the overarching narrative.
Dropped the overarching narrative and therefore lost the leverage of the public. I mean, the last time Barack Obama, what I would say, seriously leveraged the American people on behalf of his agenda was the day he got elected. And after that, he kind of turned it all to the Congress. It became a really inside game. He turned his whole agenda over to the most paralyzed and paralyzing institution in American politics.
The Congress.
The Congress, exactly. And so, you know, one of the criticisms I had was after, you remember, the fight over the grand bargain with John Boehner. And, you know, it became kind of he said, she said fight. Obama said Boehner walked away. Boehner said Obama walked away. My question all along was, why didn't you go to the people? If this grand bargain was as important as you say it was, and I believe it was, why not just say, well, he and I, we couldn't agree, and therefore I'm going back to my base? You know, he never actually brought the people into the fight.
But you know the way politics works. If he had done that before the negotiating was over, then Boehner would have been forced to walk away for the sake of his base, wouldn't he have had, and say, no, this never existed.
And then it would have been very clarifying, though. See, I think if you remember about, I don't know how many months later after that fight over the grand bargain, there was a brief fight over the payroll deduction tax extension.
At the end of
and
the
Obama
year.
Did go to the people with that. It took about a week.
And he won.
And he won.
And
it.
He won.
Okay.
That
he won. Because Republicans
the
looked at the polls. And,
yes.
And I just imagined, you know, after that fight over the grand bargain, had he called up Warren Buffett, Simpson and Bowles, said, gentlemen, hitch up your wagons. We're going on a week-long, month-long tour of the country to explain to the American people why this grand bargain is in our interest, the solution to our problem, and is really the plan for the future. Imagine if you had Warren Buffett out there talking about that, you know, not the Buffett rule. It just is it's very – I think – I mean, I've written this, so I'll say it. I think Obama has the worst communications enterprise I've ever seen in any president I've covered.
And now we know, as an aside, that – or I guess reporters knew at the time, but now it's more prominent in the public discussion – that Paul Ryan was a key to Boehner not making that deal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what happened – look, from my own reporting, which I've tried to get to the bottom of this, it's very clear. I mean, yes, at the end, Obama asked for more. He asked for more because what Reid and Pelosi told him is – the more you get on taxes, the more votes I can give you, okay? And so if you're telling me this is going to have to be passed with a lot of Democratic votes because Boehner and you know, won't be able to get that many in McConnell. But at the end of the day, Boehner and Cantor, it was very clear they couldn't deliver the Tea Party base. And one of the people they couldn't deliver was Paul Ryan.
Thomas Friedman, New York Times columnist, my guest on WNYC. His latest book, out in paperback now, That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Could Come Back, an expanded edition with a new preface. So all this criticism of Obama, but not that you seem anything of a Mitt Romney fan. As you put it, Obama's campaign has been about Romney and Romney's campaign has been about nothing.
Right.
Nothing?
Well, I mean, you know, in many ways, Brian, the funny thing about this election is both guys are running on the platform of I'm not Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney ran basically a whole primary saying, I'm not that guy who was the governor of one of the most successful states in terms of jobs, innovation, and education. And
himself.
That's right. He ran against himself. And Obama's campaign is, I'm not Mitt Romney. So we got two guys in the campaign running as, I'm not Mitt Romney. And no one's running as, here's what America needs. Here how you know are the policies I have that will actually connect us with that goal and aspiration.
And that's the whole gamble of the Ryan pick, too. He's now running as, I'm not Mitt Romney, I'm Paul Ryan. So now you have something to believe in or shoot at, and we'll see if the gamble works.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that strikes me about the commentary, you know, in the last week, I'm actually going to write my column about this in the Times tomorrow, so don't tell anybody.
I won't.
You know, everyone say Ryan's entry into the race ensures now we're going to have a serious discussion. Well, at best, for so far, it's turned into a kind of boisterous mud toss. But never mind.
But it's about Medicare.
But at least about Medicare. But we have at least three or four other issues that are deadly serious: immigration, education, energy and environment. Are we going to discuss any of those? And they're all part of this building block that we need right now.
Thomas Friedman, we'll talk to you at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 on the things we've been discussing so far, or maybe other things you've read in his column or his books, 212-433-9692. We'll also get into the Middle East as we go, or you can post your comment or question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. Maybe Romney would be a better president than he's willing to let on. You're the one who wrote this week that politicians think their job is to keep things made in America. CEOs know their job is to get things made in the world, wherever they can be made best. Perhaps, though we recoil from that notion about making things elsewhere, Romney's experience at Bain gives him exactly that perspective that would lead to policies to help American workers compete on the real contemporary stage.
Well, so let's step back, if I could, and if I can't talk about the book, because it really is the framework for this. So I may have said this when you were kind enough to have me on a year ago, but when Michael and I sat down to write this book, that used to be us, one of the first things I did was go back to the book I wrote in 2004, 2005, which we also talked about then, The World is Flat. And that was a book really about how the world is getting connected. So when I sat down with Michael to write this book, first thing I did was I got the first edition of The World is Flat off the bookshelf, opened it up to the index, looked under FFFA, Facebook wasn't in it. So when I was out there, Brian, saying, the world is flat, we're all connected, Facebook didn't exist, Twitter was still a sound, the cloud was still in the sky, 4G was a parking place, LinkedIn was a prison, applications were what you sent to college, and for most people, Skype was a typo. Okay, all of that happened after, you know, I was writing that the world is flat. So what that has done, and I think this is the central organizing point of our time, it's taken the world from connected to hyperconnected. Now, what that's done is imagine the whole world were a single math class. Well, the curve just rose. Why? Because all those CEOs, which you were talking about, I was writing about, they now, Brian, from 8 years ago, they have access to so much more cheap automation, cheap software, cheap robotics, cheap labor, and cheap genius than ever before. And so what we argue in the book is that the central socioeconomic point of our time is that average is over. Average is officially over now. If all you do is average now, if you can't bring something extra in a world where the whole global curve has risen, you're not going to earn an average wage to live an average lifestyle.
But and, as Garrison Keillor knows, not everybody can be above average.
Exactly. Well, this is a challenge. I think everyone actually is above average at something. But what it means is this. And this, if you ask me, hey, Tom, if you could reduce this election to one issue, if it were about one issue, would it be about Medicare? No, it would be about this statistic, Brent. The unemployment rate today for people with 4 years of college education is 4.1%. That means basically no education. No unemployment. That's people just switching jobs. The unemployment rate for people who drop out of high school is over 13%. The unemployment rate for people who just complete high school, 11%. The unemployment rate for people who have up to 2 years of college or post-secondary education, can be vocational as well, 7%. So what does that tell you? It tells you in a world where average is over, the single most important thing you can do is get more education, because there isn't a job in your newsroom or the New York Times or in any manufacturing company today that is a good job that doesn't require more and better education.
But what if we had a country of 100% college-educated adults instead of, what is it now, under 50% with a four-year degree? Wouldn't there still be a lot of unemployment because there aren't that many high-skill jobs to go around?
Well, see, that's where I disagree. And, you know, there is no such thing as a lump of labor. You know, that there's a lump of labor, and I've got some, and you've got some, but he or she doesn't. You know, things are constantly being invented, reinvented, refined. Whoever knew about Facebook, Twitter, think of all the jobs that those things are spinning off. But we only one thing we know about those jobs. They require more education in order to get the best part of that job.
Bonnie on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Thomas Friedman. Hello.
Hi. I have read Mr. Friedman. I admire a lot of what he's written. But this stuff was available to see by anyone. I'm just an ordinary person on Staten Island. Mm. And I was writing to the president and to my congressmen and senators about exactly this point 2.5 years ago, mm-hmm. about the lack of addressing the housing issue, for starters. That's still an overhang on the economy. There's no coherence here. There is no overarching, this is where we have to go. And the Republicans are just, they've just got their heads up a dark passageway that leads to no place. It's George Bush on steroids, and we all know that's how we got to where we are. So if none of these supposedly vaunted politicians have a vision of anything, and the media refuses to ask, really, I mean, Brian is maybe the only person on the media today that actually asks probing questions, and he's so nice about it that, you know, he can't pursue these seriously. What is your suggestion? How do you get these people to go someplace to present a vision, to have someplace for people to rally around? It cannot be, I am the great person, I am the savior.
All right, but I'm going to leave it there. Let's get a response.
Well, it's a very, Bonnie, thank you. It's a very good question. And this, you know, one of the things, of course, we argued in our book is that politicians are like anyone else. They respond to incentives. You move the cheese, you move the mouse. Don't move the cheese, the mouse doesn't move. So right now, they're obviously responding to incentives that you and I and Bonnie say, that's crazy. Why are you going there? But they're rational people. They want to get reelected. They want to raise money. And so what we've argued, of course, in the book is that's why we needed a third party, that we needed a third party to come in and actually articulate the kind of agenda that Bonnie's talking about, that I've been trying to talk about, and show politicians on both sides, whoa, there is a pile of cheese there, you know, for a rational, sane, progressive, forward-looking agenda. That's the only way. You got to change the incentives. And right now, Brian, the incentives are all screwed up.
We'll continue with Thomas Friedman in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. His latest book, written with Michael Mandelbaum, is That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back, out in paperback now with an expanded edition with a new preface. And Patrick in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
How you doing?
Good. I just wanted to address Tom Friedman's assertion that Obama's not telling a story. I suspect that Obama is not telling the story that Mr. Friedman wants to hear. And first, I'd like to say that President Obama did, in fact, appeal to the people on health care. If you remember, in his, I think it was the State of the Union, suggested kind of novelly that people call their Congress people. And if I recall, that really kind of gave the bill a push, mm-hmm. and it wound up passing. By contrast, I think he did not appeal to the people on Grand Bargain and would never do that because it's incredibly unpopular and I would even suggest undemocratic to even kind of, you know, strike these Grand Bargains in the first place. It's it all kinds of smacks of backroom dealing and, you know, screwing over certain constituencies when they didn't ask for it.
Well, Congress still would have had to vote for it and so presumably hear from their various constituencies around the country before doing so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, either we have a grand bargain that deals with our long-term fiscal imbalances, and the question is, what shape does that bargain take? How much tax increase do we have in that formula? How much in spending cuts? Either we have that, or eventually the market will weigh in and force us to do it in a, I would argue, very crude way. I mean, so I don't think there was anything that Obama was particularly embarrassed about. I think he was worried, and I think the caller has a legitimate point, in that obviously it was going to involve some kind of cuts in Medicare spending, some kind in Social Security. But at the same time, I think he could have sold it as something that's going to actually preserve Social Security and Medicare for another generation.
Are you a fan of the Obama health reform? Isn't that in a way a very 20th century Rube Goldberg contraption, or do you think it has incentives to push new models of efficient quality care?
I am a fan. I've supported it from the very beginning. I'm sorry it took so long because it took us away from other parts of the agenda. That was a legislative issue. I'm for it for two reasons, main reasons, Brent. One is that I just think to be a humane modern society, we can't have 40 million people walking around without health care, number one. And number two, there are innovative experiments in this legislation that I think could drive a lot of change. And when I'm not an expert on healthcare, but wherever whenever I am in the presence of people who run hospitals or work in hospitals and ask doctors, I'm struck by the kind of reaction I get, which is they say it's complicated here, it's messy there, but on balance, I think, you know, this could be a good thing. It's not going to be perfect, and maybe we can, and I'm sure we will fix it as we go along, but I think we had to start down this road.
David on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi. It's not that Obama didn't tell a story. He told a great story, a phony story. If people knew what he actually was going to do, they wouldn't have voted for him. And contrary to what Mr. Friedman says, Romney spent the whole campaign explaining why he'd be different from Obama. On day one, he'd approve Keystone. He would end Obamacare, and the $700 billion it steals from Medicare will be returned. He will reverse the Justice Department's anti-Arizona, even anti-Boeing type of behavior. He will never again do a stimulus that takes money from the taxpayers and gives it to extend briefly civil service people's careers.
David, thank you. That's a lot of specific points. Whether or not you agree with him, he's saying Romney campaign is about something.
Look, that's certainly a point of view. He said he would kill Obamacare. Not sure what he would put in its place. He says that, well, we're not going to get any more stimulus, so even if Obama wanted it.
Were you a fan of the stimulus? We have Michael Grunwald from Time Magazine coming on later in the show, who has this whole new book about how the stimulus was actually the greatest thing since sliced bread, but nobody appreciates it.
I don't know if it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I supported it at the time. I think it was essential to stem us from sliding from recession into depression. And I think that people don't – we now take it for granted, oh, Obama did this stimulus. You know, by the way, Bush, you know, started it. Let's not forget that too. You know,
when the financial crisis first hit on his
watch. So, you know, I mean, you know, Brian, we can get into this. He said, she said, Romney this. You know, what our book really is about, it's about what this campaign I think should be about, which is how we got here, how we became a successful country. We didn't get here by accident. We got here because we had a five-part formula for success. We educated people up to and beyond whatever the technology was so they could get the most out of it. We had the best immigration policy to attract the most talented and energetic people from around the world. We had the best infrastructure. We had the best rules to incentivize risk-taking and to prevent recklessness. And we had the most government-funded research. That was our five-part formula for success. And right now, if you look at all five, All five are ailings, put it that way. And until and unless we get back to those fundamentals, you know, arguing about this and that and minor thing, it's all just chaff and noise. It's not going to get us there. We didn't get into this hole easily and quickly, and we're not going to get out of it easily and quickly. But we will get out of it if we go back to the things we did right. That's why our book is a forward-looking theme but a backward-looking title. That used to be us. We used to do this. We did this before. We can do it again.
In the book, you see China as reminding Americans of how we used to be, an educational success and industrial prowess. That used to be us. Is it the right way to see China?
Well, you know, again, we just mentioned China literally on 1.5 pages of the book. The book is not about China because our view is whether China succeeds or fails doesn't matter. We've got the formula right here. But what we say in the book is that we think a lot of people in America look at China and see in them things they miss in us. And this may be contrived. It may be imposed. But what they see is a country that can still act collectively. And again, that may be just imposed. I don't think it's all imposed, but a lot of it is imposed. But I think what people miss about America today, because they understand these big problems we face, whether it's energy and climate, education, immigration, debt and deficit, they can only be addressed, Brian, effectively and sustainably if we act together. And what we feel, and we argue in the book, we've lost our ability to do big, hard things together.
Did we get lazy and bloated, too, expecting too much material comfort for too little work?
Yeah, well, I think that basically during the last 20, 30 years, one of the things we happened is we tried to get rich the cheap way through credit, a lot of household credit, and a lot of national credit. And rather than the kind of skill building, infrastructure, immigration, the right rule, the basics that we did in the past, there was a difference. And we have really run up quite a bill that we're going to have to pay down.
Do we have to downsize our lifestyles? As a global affairs columnist, mm-hmm. you would be aware that we're 5% of the world's population. But what's the number? We consume 30% of the world's energy? Maybe our lifestyle expectations need to come down a peg, I hate to say it, so we don't consume ourselves into needing more and more in a way that we can never actually satisfy.
You know, when I wrote the last book I was on here with you, Brian, you know, on energy and environment, something I'm sure we talked about. And my attitude is that it may be that as we go from 7 to 9 billion people, you know, on this planet, that that we have to downsize our lifestyle. But before I go telling people they have to do that, okay – could we just turn off the lights? In other words, there's so much low-hanging fruit that we don't do, just basic efficiency things that we could save tremendous amounts of energy and the environment. So before I come to that in conclusion, let's try to do the right things, implement the right technologies. Then let's have that discussion.
New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, his latest book, That Used to Be Us. I want to spend a couple of minutes, as you know, on the Middle East. There's so much going on. One report is of Israel preparing for a 30-day war with Iran. I'm sure they're preparing for all kinds of potential scenarios, as they must. But do you take this as meaning war is more imminent than it was?
Brian, had we been on 6 months ago, I would have said it's 2 in 10. Had you had me on 4 months ago, I would have said 4 in 10. Today, I would tell you I think there's a solid 50-50 chance that there is an Israeli military operation against Iran before the election. And I say that from no inside information, just from reading the Israeli press. It's very clear.
What would trigger it? Just a certain amount of intelligence that the nuclear program has progressed to a certain point?
Two things. One, that. And the other, the fact that Iran's in a process of hardening its main site at Fordor where this nuclear technology is going on at the biggest scale. And the Israelis have only so much technology. So the harder the site gets, the more that technology becomes ineffective. We, of course, have much greater technology. So we can say, oh, it can get harder and harder and harder. We don't really care. We can take it out. They can't. So the combination of getting closer to weaponization and hardening, entering a zone of what they call invulnerability, is something that's clearly weighing on the Israeli decision makers.
In the context of the election, you wrote a column very critical of the Romney trip to Israel, where you said he was just pandering to Sheldon Adelson's deep pockets by pandering to the Israeli extreme right. And you quoted the Israeli defense minister, Ehud Barak, saying this, and we pulled the clip, about the Obama administration, and this is going to surprise a lot of people.
I can see along years administrations of both sides of the political aisle deeply supporting the State of Israel. I believe that that reflects a profound feelings among the American people. But I should tell you honestly that this administration under President Obama is doing in regard to our security more than anything that I can remember in the past.
The Obama administration doing more for Israeli security than any administration that the Israeli defense minister can remember in the past. That's not what his Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu thinks, is it?
Well, you know, I think between Bibi and President Obama, Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Obama, there's a chemistry problem, among other things. I always had this feeling that there was some guy on the Harvard Law Review when Obama was there who just Netanyahu reminds him of, and they're just some of the bad in the past.
But hasn't Obama also blown it on Israel by emphasizing that settlements are an obstacle to peace, which is certainly a legitimate argument to make, but not the equivalent Arab failures in the same public way?
Well, I think that I have no problem saying that settlements are an obstacle to peace. They are, and that's been our policy for a long time. But I think Obama could have done more to reach out to the Israeli public at the same time and pair that message with one that says, I understand your security concerns at a very deep level. But then you listen to what Barak is saying, and that's exactly how he's acted in ways that are actually decisive and important. And that is the level – and this is what I only know from my own sources – but the level of strategic cooperation At the intelligence level and at the technological level, my colleague David Sanger from the New York Times reported that it was actually a joint Israeli-American project that invented the Stuxnet worm that slowed down the Israeli program. You know, this is very deep level of cooperation Obama's embarked on.
Very quickly, another column last month was headlined, "What Does Morsi Mean for Israel?" And since you wrote that, there seems to be one positive, one negative indicator at least. He seems to have passed the test in the Sinai crisis of not letting the militants control the Sinai-Gaza border. But he has agreed to go to Tehran, which concerns Israel because Ahmadinejad has been more threatening, hate-mongering in his speech than ever, talking about Israel should cease to exist and all of that. In 30 seconds, how's your Morsi scorecard looking?
It's looking worried. You know, I respect the fact that he's popularly elected, but I also respect the fact that he won by a sliver of a margin, that there's a lot of Egyptians that wanted a secular, more liberal and progressive administration. I think our policy toward him has to be draw red lines where necessary, where we see that he's acting in ways that do not comport with our own values and interests, and build bridges where possible. But this, Brian, you and I are going to be talking about this for a long, long time.
Because democracy is just beginning
exactly.
In Egypt. It's a whole new world. One more thing before you go. We're doing a series, as you know, called That's My Issue, inviting people to talk about things in their own life experience that have shaped their politics. Now, you learn about the world for your job, but anything from your more personal experience that shaped your worldview early on or changed it at any point, parenthood, making more money than you expected to make, whatever?
Brian, it's no, you know, you won't be surprised by this. You know, people note that I'm kind of a congenital optimist, maybe in a goofy way, whatever. That is what it is. And it comes from the fact that I grew up in Minnesota in the 50s and 60s and early 70s at a time when Minnesota really worked. In fact, when I graduated high school in 1971, the governor of Minnesota was on the cover of Time magazine under the headline, "The State That Works." My two congressmen were both liberal Republicans. My senators were named Walter Mondale, Eugene McCarthy, Hubert Humphrey. And the companies in Minnesota, the Control Data's, Dayton Hudson, Target, saw it as their civic responsibility to build the Tyrone Guthrie Theater. I grew up in a community that worked, and I spent a lot of my life basically going around the world looking for Minnesota.
If only all the world was Minnesota. Thomas Friedman with Michael Mandelbaum has written That Used to Be Us. Tom, thank you very much as always.
Great pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, is Westchester County failing to live up to its affordable housing agreement? We will talk to an official of the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department who's trying to pressure Westchester to create those affordable units and in the right places. Stay with us.